Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week in the United States and in more than 70 countries worldwide on the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit my webpage. That's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law news and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on lies that my teacher told me. You know, we Americans are the most litigious people in the world, and we believe in our lawyers with a kind of religious fervor, don't we? And we're taught from early childhood that he who represents himself in court as a fool for a client. But what would you say if a plumber said that? What if your plumber said, he who fixes his own pipes as a fool for a client? Or what if a carpenter said, he who fixes his own steps as a fool for a client? Well, doesn't our common sense tell us that a plumber or a carpenter who couldn't fix his own pipes or steps is incompetent? You know, my common sense tells me that a lawyer who couldn't represent himself in court has to be just as incompetent as that plumber or that carpenter. Well, listen to James Nielsen. Now, he's a professor at the Hastings Law School. Here's what he had to say about lawyers. He said, quote, "It is a fact that a student can graduate from this, the fourth largest law school in the United States, without ever having written a pleading, a contract, a will, a promissory note, or a deed, and it's worse than that. Most students graduate from this law school without ever having seen a real honest-to-God pleading, contract, will, promissory note, or a deed, and a student can graduate without having set foot in a courtroom, without ever having spoken to or on behalf of a person in need of advice or counsel, and a student can graduate without once being exposed to the operation of the rules of court. Now, whatever else may be said about this license issued by the state bar, let it be said that for these students and their clients, that it is a cruel hoax." Now, that's Professor James Nielsen of the Hastings Law School. Now, for more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you call the law school and ask for my free general law CD package. That's 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. If you're online, you can go to the webpage, georgegordon.org, click onto the email machine and send me an email, and just ask for that free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or you can call direct 417-273-4967. You know, all of us have been handicapped by history. In the process of hero-making in history is one of those handicapping processes. So, in the book, Lies That My Teacher Told Me by James Loewen, published by New York Press, copyrighted in 1995, my boy came in and said, you know, there's about 20 or 30 web pages out there that have this guy's book on it. So there's a few other people that are concerned about the lies in history. Of course, here on the Law Hour and Editorial Review, our prime motivation is exposing all of the lies and chicanery that go on in a variety of disciplines, subjects, and topics, politics just being one of them. So I thought, gee, look at this story here on history. This chapter is about heroification, the making of heroes. It's a degenerative process, much like calcification, that takes and makes people over into heroes. And it's through this process that our educational media turns the flesh and blood individuals into pious, perfect creatures without conflicts, without pain, without any credibility or human interest either. Well, many American history textbooks are studded with biographical vignettes of the very famous. For instance, Land of Promise devotes a box to each president. And then the famous The Challenge of Freedom provides, did you know, boxes about Elizabeth Blackwell, the first woman to graduate from medical school in the United States. And Lorraine Hensberry, the author of Raisin in the Sun, among many others. In themselves, these vignettes are not a bad idea. They instruct by human example. They show diverse ways that people can make a difference. They allow textbooks to give space to characters such as Blackwell and Hensberry, who relieve what would otherwise be a monolithic parade of white male political leaders. Biographical vignettes also provoke reflection as to our purpose in teaching history. Is Chester A. Arthur more deserving of space than, let's say, Frank Lloyd Wright, who influences us more today than Arthur ever did? Wright, who invented the carport and transformed a domestic architectural spaces, or Arthur, who signed the first Civil Service Act, whose rise to prominence provides more drama, Blackwell's or George Bush? The latter, born with a silver Senate seat in his mouth, the choices are very debatable, but surely textbooks should include some people based not only on what they achieved, but also on the distance that they traveled or traversed to achieve it. We could go on to third and fourth guess the list of heroes and textbooks and pantheons, but my concern here, however, is not who gets chosen, but rather what happens to the heroes when they've been introduced into our history textbooks and into our classrooms. Two 20th century Americans provide case studies of heroification. One, Woodrow Wilson, the other, Helen Keller. Woodrow Wilson was unarguably an important president, and he receives extensive textbook coverage. Helen Keller, on the other hand, was a little person who pushed through no legislation. She changed the course of no scientific discipline, and she never declared war on anybody. Now, only one of the 12 history textbooks that I surveyed includes her photograph. But teachers love to talk about Helen Keller and often show audiovisual materials or recommend biographies that present her life as being one that was very exemplary. Now, all of this attention ensures that students retain something about both of these historical figures, but they may be no better off for it. Heroification so distorts the lives of Keller and Wilson and many others that we cannot think straight about either one of them. Teachers have held up Helen Keller, the blind and deaf girl who overcame her physical handicaps, as an inspiration to generations of school children everywhere. Every fifth grader knows the scene in which Anne Sullivan spills water into young Helen's hand at the pump. At least a dozen movies and film strips have been made on Keller's life, and each yields its version of the same cliche. A McGraw-Hill educational film concludes, quote, "The gift of Helen Keller and Anne Sullivan to the world is to constantly remind us of the wonder of the world around us and how much we owe those who taught us what it means. For there is no person that is unworthy or incapable of being helped, and the greatest service any person can make us is to help another reach their true potential." Unquote. Now, to draw such a bland maxim from the life of Helen Keller, historians and filmmakers have disregarded her actual biography and left out the lessons that she specifically asked us to learn from it. Keller, who struggled so valiantly to learn to speak, has been made mute by history and history books. The result is that we really don't know much about her, now do we? Well, over the past 10 years, I've asked dozens of college students who Helen Keller was and what did she do. Now, they all know that she was blind and deaf. Most of them know that she was befriended by a teacher, Anne Sullivan, and she learned to read and write and even to speak. some students can recall rather minute details of Keller's early life, and she lived in Alabama, and that she was unruly and without manners before Sullivan came along, and so forth. A few know that Helen graduated from college. But about what happened next, about the whole of her adult life, they're totally ignorant. And a few students venture that Keller became a public figure or a humanitarian, perhaps on behalf of the blind or the deaf. She wrote, didn't she? Or she spoke conjectures without content. Keller, who was born in 1880, graduated from Radcliffe College in 1904. She died in 1968. To ignore the 64 years of her adult life or to encapsulate them with the single word humanitarian is to lie by omission. Now, the truth is that Helen Keller was a radical socialist. She joined the Socialist Party of Massachusetts in 1909. She had become a social radical even before she graduated from Radcliffe. And not, she emphasized, because of any teachings available there. After a Russian revolution, she sang the praises of the new communist nation. In the East, a new star is risen, and with pain and anguish, the old order was given birth to the new. And behold, in the East, a man-child is born. Onward, comrades, all together. Onward to the campfires of Russia. Onward to the coming dawn. Helen Keller hung a red flag over the desk in her study. Gradually, she moved to the left of the Socialist Party and became a Wobbly, a member of the Industrial Workers of the World, the IWW, the syndicalist union persecuted by Woodrow Wilson. Keller's commitment to socialism stemmed from her experience as a disabled person and from her sympathy for others with handicaps. She began by working to simplify the alphabet for the blind, but soon came to realize that to deal solely with blindness was to treat a symptom, not the cause. So through research, she learned that blindness was not distributed randomly throughout the population, but was concentrated in the lower class. Men who were poor might be blinded in industrial accidents or by inadequate medical care. Poor women who became prostitutes faced the additional danger of syphilis blindness. Thus, Keller learned how the social class system controls people's opportunities in life, sometimes determining even whether they can see. So Keller's research was not just book learning. She said, "I have visited sweatshops, factories, and crowded slums. If I could not see it, I could smell it." At the time Keller became a socialist, she was one of the most famous women on planet Earth. She soon became the most notorious. Her conversion to socialism caused a new storm of publicity, this time outraged. Newspapers that had extolled her courage and intelligence now emphasized her handicap. Columnists charged that she had no independent sensory input and was enthralled to those who fed her information. Typical was the editor of the Brooklyn Eagle, who wrote that Keller's mistakes spring out of the manifest limitations of her development. Unquote. Helen Keller recalled having met this editor, and at the time, the compliments that he paid me were so generous that I blush to remember them. But now that I have come out for socialism, he reminds me and the public that I am blind and deaf and especially liable to error. I must have shrunk in intelligence during the years since I met him. She went on, "Oh, ridiculous Brooklyn Eagle, socially blind and deaf, it defends an intolerable system, a system that is the cause of much of the physical blindness and deafness which we are trying to prevent. Keller, who devoted much of her later life to raising funds for the American Foundation for the Blind, never wavered in her belief that her society needed radical change. Having herself fought so hard to speak, she helped found the American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU, to fight for the free speech of others. She sent $100 to the NAACP with a letter of support that appeared in its magazine, The Crisis. A radical act for a white person from Alabama in the 1920s, she supported Eugene V. Debs, the socialist candidate, in each of his campaigns for the presidency. She composed essays on women's movements, on politics, on economics, and near the end of her life, she wrote to Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, the leader of the American Communist Party, who was then languishing in jail, a victim of the McCarthy era. Loving birthday greetings, dear Elizabeth Flynn. May the sense of serving mankind bring strength and peace into your brave heart, said Keller. Now, you may not agree with Helen Keller's positions or her political philosophies and ideologies. Her praise of the USSR now seems naive, embarrassing, to some even treasonous. But she was a radical, a fact that very few Americans know because our schooling and our mass media have simply left it out. What we did not learn about Woodrow Wilson is even more remarkable. What we know about Wilson is based upon lies, and what we don't know about him is even worse. So when I ask my college students to tell me what they recall about President Wilson, they respond with enthusiasm. They say that Wilson led our country reluctantly into World War I. And then after the war, they led the struggle nationally and internationally to establish the League of Nations. Young college students associate Wilson with progressive causes like women's suffrage. A handful of students recalled that Wilson's administration's Palmer raids against left-wing unions, but my students very seldom know or speak about two anti-democratic policies that Wilson carried out during his administration: his racial segregation of the federal government and his military interventions in foreign countries. Under Woodrow Wilson, the United States intervened in Latin America more often than at any other time in our history. We landed troops in Mexico in 1914, Haiti in 1915, the Dominican Republic in 1916, Mexico again in 1916, and nine more times before the end of Wilson's presidency. We landed American troops in Cuba in 1917 and Panama in 1918, and throughout Wilson's administration, Wilson maintained forces in Nicaragua, using them to determine Nicaragua's president and to force passage of a treaty, preferential to the United States, of course. In 1917, Wilson took on a major power when he started sending secret monetary aid to the white side of the Russian Civil War. In the summer of 1918, he authorized a naval blockade of the Soviet Union, and he sent expeditionary forces to Murmansk, Archangel, and Vladivostok to help overthrow the Russian Revolution. With the blessing of Britain and France, and in a joint command with Japanese soldiers, American forces penetrated westward from Vladivostok to Lake Baikal, supporting Czech and White Russian forces that had declared an anti-communist government headquartered in Omsk. After briefly maintaining front lines as far west as the Volga River, the White Russian forces disintegrated by the end of 1919, and our troops finally left Vladivostok on April 1st. 1920. Now, who would have ever thought that Helen Keller was a radical socialist communist, or that Woodrow Wilson makes George Bush look like a conservative emancipating the Monroe Doctrine? Huh? Hang on, we'll be back with more right after this. Don't go away.
All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. You know, the lessons on courtroom strategy and procedure that you hear on this show are just a small part of my two-week basic courtroom strategy and procedures class, and this class includes lessons on what to do and what not to do at the arrest or when you're served with a summons, citation, or a complaint. Now, rule number one, remember, is don't say anything, keep your mouth shut, and shut up. Now, if you can learn rule one, you can win about 90% of your legal cases. And that's because all of the evidence that's ever going to be used against you is going to be furnished by you. Now, your government is fully capable of making their own case without any help from you whatsoever. Listen to this. Listen to what the courts have to say about keeping quiet in the face of police interrogation and, in fact, in some cases, police intimidation. The first judge put it this way. He said, who would believe the ironic truth that the cooperative taxpayer fares much worse than the individual who relies upon his constitutional rights? He said that in U.S. versus Dickerson. Second judge put it this way. He said, you can and you must keep your mouth shut for protection under the Fifth Amendment. That comes from Belknap versus United States. And the third judge said, the constitutional privilege was intended to shield the guilty and the imprudent, as well as the innocent and far-sighted. And he said that in Marchetti versus United States. Now, if you'd like more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you call me here at the law school? The number is 417-273-4967. And be sure to ask for my free general law CD package while you're at it. Remember, that's a four-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative. Best of all, it's free of charge, and you can call and order yours right now. That number, 417-273-4967. And courtroom strategy and procedures available on compact disc for adult home education. If you can't come to school here, we'll bring the school to you. And if you're online, just go to the website, that's georgegordon.org, click onto the email and send me an email request for your free general law CD package. That's the place to start. Why don't you do it right now before you forget? All right, we're talking about President Woodrow Wilson. I might remind you that this is lies my teacher told me. And you can rest assured that your teacher was telling you plenty of lies if you went to public school like I did. James Loewen, that's L-O-E-W-E-N, James Loewen. New York Press, copyright 1995. We're talking about President Woodrow Wilson. America was a rogue nation. In fact, it still is. Rogue. That is, a nation that's out of control. A nation that operates outside the norms of international law. United States forces have been used in more than 80 countries around the world since 1787. That's right. In our 225-year history, we have invaded and conquered numerous nations. That's why America is called the rogue nation. So America's invasion of Iraq isn't anything new. It's just a part of a long train of events that's been going on for 200 plus years. If the Chinese were to attack another country, you know, like they came in on the side of North Korea and we just bellyached something terrible and we said, oh my God, look at these Chinese coming across international frontiers and fighting against us. Well, the Russians, what would you think if the Russians came into Cuba? See, when they did that back in the early 1960s, we just had conniption fits, didn't we? Well, listen to this. This is President Woodrow Wilson back about 1920. Now, for you Americans who were not alive at the time and don't know anything about our unknown war with Russia, to quote the little or the title of Robert Maddox's book on this fiasco, not one of the 12 American history textbooks in my sample even mentions American involvement in the Russian Revolution. And Russian history textbooks, on the other hand, give the episode considerable coverage. According to Maddox, the immediate effect of the intervention was to prolong a bloody civil war, thereby costing thousands of additional lives and wreaking enormous destruction on an already battered society. And there were longer-range implications. Bolshevik leaders had clear proof that the Western powers meant to destroy the Soviet government if they were given a chance. This aggression fueled the suspicions that motivated the Soviets during the Cold War, and until its breakup, the Soviet Union continued to claim damages for the invasion. Wilson's invasion of Latin America, or Wilson's invasions, plural, of Latin America are better known than his Russian adventure. Textbooks do cover some of them, and it is fascinating to watch textbook authors attempt to justify these episodes. Any accurate portrayal of the invasions could not possibly show Woodrow Wilson or the United States in a favorable light. With hindsight, we know that Wilson's interventions in Cuba, the Dominican Republic, Haiti, and Nicaragua set the stage for the dictators, Batista, Trujillo, the Duvaliers, and the Somozas, whose legacies still reverberate in those countries. Even in the 1910s, most of the invasions were unpopular in this country and provoked a torrent of criticism abroad. By the mid-1920s, Wilson's successors reversed his policies in Latin America. The authors of history textbooks know this. For a chapter or two after Wilson, they laud our good neighbor policy, the reunification of force, or the renunciation of force in Latin America by Presidents Coolidge and Hoover, which was extended by Franklin D. Roosevelt. The textbooks might, but they do not, call Wilson's Latin America's actions a bad neighbor policy. Instead, when faced with unpleasantries, the textbooks wriggle to get the hero off the hook, as in this example from The Challenge of Freedom. It says, quote, President Wilson wanted the United States to build friendships with the countries of Latin America. However, he found this difficult. Some textbooks blame the invasions on the countries invaded. They say, quote, necessity was the mother of armed Caribbean intervention, unquote, states the American pageant Land of Promise. It's vague as to who caused the invasions, but seems certain that they were not Wilson's fault or Wilson's doing. It says, quote, he soon discovered, this is speaking of Wilson, Wilson soon discovered that because of forces that he could not control, his ideas of morality and idealism had to give way to practical action, unquote. Promise goes on to assert Wilson's innocence. Thus, though he believed it morally undesirable to send Marines into the Caribbean, he saw no way to avoid it. And this passage is sheer invention. Unlike his Secretary of the Navy, who later complained that what Wilson forced me, that's his Secretary of the Navy, to do in Haiti, was a bitter pill for me, no documentary evidence suggests that Wilson suffered any such qualms about dispatching troops to the Caribbean. After all, he was enforcing the Monroe Doctrine. All 12 of the textbooks that I surveyed mention Wilson's 1914 invasion of Mexico, but they posit that the interventions were not Wilson's fault. They say President Wilson was urged to send military forces into Mexico to protect American investments and to restore law and order. And according to Triumph of the American Nation, whose authors emphasize that the president at first chose not to intervene, but as the months passed, even President Wilson began to lose patience. Walter Karp has shown that his version contradicts the facts. The invasion was Wilson's idea from the start, and it outraged Congress as well as the American people. And according to Karp, Wilson's intervention was so outrageous that leaders of both sides of Mexico's ongoing civil war demanded that the United States forces leave. The pressure of public opinion in the United States and around the world finally influenced Wilson to recall the troops. Textbook authors commonly use another device when describing our Mexican adventures. They identify Wilson as ordering our forces to withdraw, but nobody is specified as having ordered them in. imparting information in a passive voice helps to insulate historical figures from their own unheroic or unethical deeds. Well, let's take a minute here and make a little editorial comment. Think about this. You're going to write a history textbook, and you're working for a publisher. And this publishing company wants to sell 1 million or 2 million or 3 million of these textbooks all over the United States. Now, the people who review these textbooks sit on the Board of Education. Now, let's just take my little neighborhood down here in Ozark County. We have about 2,700 voters in our county. About 250 of them are Democrats, and the other 2,500 voters are all Republicans. Now, who do you think sits on the school boards here in Ozark County, Missouri? Democrats or Republicans? Well, you guessed it. They're all Republicans. Now, let's write a history textbook. And in that history textbook, let's tell the truth about what goes on in history. And that truth might disparage some Republican. And do you think that the Republicans sitting on the school board, if they've got two history books to choose from, one of the history textbooks lambastes President Wilson, who was a Democrat? Boy, our guys in this county are going to buy that textbook. Aren't they? You bet they are. And let's suppose that that history textbook tells the truth about Abraham Lincoln. Do you think that we're going to buy that textbook? You see, the people here were Southerners, and this part of Missouri was on the Confederate side. So if you write the truth about the Civil War, they're not going to buy those textbooks. So the authors of the textbooks write the history the way the school boards want it to read so that they can sell the textbooks to the people in that region of the country. So the history textbooks simply leave out that which is the truth concerning President Wilson or Lincoln or Bill Clinton or whoever it's going to be. They do it for political purposes. It's just money. It's nothing personal. Don't misunderstand. It's nothing personal. It's just money. Now, meanwhile, back on the farm, you and I simply do not get the truth concerning what really happened. And then we go out into the marketplace, and then we're going to run for the school board. And when we get on the school board, then our skewered view of the world, and when we read a history textbook that we're considering and it doesn't fit with your personal ideology, whether you're a Yankee or a Southerner, you're either going to buy the textbook or you're not going to buy the textbook based upon your own personal prejudices. It has nothing to do with truth or error. It has to do with your own personal prejudices. That's the way we view the Bible. It's the way we view religion. It's the way we view economics and the social issues, whether it be abortion or anti-abortion or whatever. Now, textbook authors commonly use another device when describing our Mexican adventures. They identify Wilson as ordering our forces to withdraw, but nobody is specified as having ordered them in. So, here's the textbook. Did you catch that? The textbook comes along and says, boy, our president ordered our troops to withdraw. Wow. That makes our hero, President Wilson, a hero. And remember that this is a liberal society today in the year 2004. We're a nation of liberals. And Wilson was a liberal, so we want a picture. The textbooks picture all the liberals as being people of moral fortitude and good people that are just out here just working around. But you'll notice they leave God out of the picture. But when you have a guy like John Brown or President Lincoln, who were moral people, who believed in God and believed in the Bible, and said it in their inaugural address or when they wrote a letter out of prison, oh, we can't have that. We don't want the Bible.
in our history textbooks. That might give students the idea that God and the Bible have a place in secular history or politics. But we can't have that. So then you've got to worry about having lawsuits. And so here comes the ACLU along and says, well, you can't have that history textbook in here. Well, it violates the separation of church and state doctrine or something else. Now, some books go beyond omitting the actor and leave out the act itself. Half of the 12 textbooks do not even mention Wilson's takeover of Haiti. So after the U.S. Marines invaded the country in 1915, they forced the Haitian legislature to select our preferred candidate as president. Let me just pause for a moment. Isn't that what we're doing over in Iraq right now? You see, the conquering power, the United States of America, wants to establish democracy. We want to establish our form of government in Iraq. Those people don't practice democracy over there. They never have. Those people are Arabs. Those are the children of Ishmael. They have a different view of the world. They believe that their government should be a theocratic government ruled by their church, by their religious ideology and organization. The Mormons do the same thing. The Mormons believe that their church should rule Utah. And it does. And all the politicians in Utah are Mormons. Well, for practical purposes, I mean, there might be two or three Jews in there, but they slipped in accidentally, pretending to be Mormon. And the Mormons love it that way. And I'm sitting over here in Missouri saying, what do we care about how the Mormons rule themselves? Well, but you see, that Mormon church over there might rule over those people and they might not be fair. What do we care? I want to ask you, what do we people here in Missouri care about how those people over in Iraq are being ruled over? I know. I heard President Bush, he stood up there at the Republican convention and he said, you know, we have freed 26 million people and now those people hate our guts. You know, they keep telling us every day, God, these people, they just love us. Look at all the schools that we're building, all these good works that we're doing. Well, okay. But you take a look in the Arab world and in the Muslim world, take a look at Chechnya. I'll read you a story here when I get a little time here concerning what the Iraqi soccer team that just went to the Olympics had to say about President Bush using them as an example of freedom. They, to a man, said, don't use our soccer team for your own political purposes. Now, the people in Iraq believe that they're better able to govern themselves than we Americans, and we have installed a puppet government. That's all that is. It's a puppet government. Now, we've done that in Iraq two or three times, and that's because, you see, Iraq to us is a very valuable, a very important source of oil. So is Saudi Arabia. The reason that we put in that Saudi Arabian monarchy is so that the United States of America can govern and rule Saudi Arabia through their monarchy. And we're going to install a puppet government in Iraq so that we can rule Iraq from Washington, D.C. And those Iraqis don't like that idea at all. They think it sucks. They're sitting over there saying, no, we don't like this idea at all. We want you Americans to get the hell out of our lives and leave us alone. And, of course, the United States has all of the political, financial, and military muscle in the world. And so what are they going to do? They're going to strap on belts and go blow themselves up and kill as many of us as they can because it's the only way they can effectively fight us. Take a look at the Chechens over there fighting the Russians. The Russian army went in and crushed Chechnya. All right. So instead of giving up and saying, well, okay, we'll join Russia, they said, we'll fight you to the death. And so there you have terrorism. Hey, we got to take another break here. Hang on. Stand by, and I'll be right back with more on the lies our teachers told us. All right. You're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri.
Now, the lessons on courtroom strategy and procedure that you hear on this program are just a small part of my 2-week basic courtroom strategy and procedure school. This class includes lessons on what to do and what not to do at the scene of the alleged crime, what you should say to the police or investigators, and what you ought not to say to the police. And you'll learn how to conduct yourself and your case at bail setting, arraignment, pleadings, motion hearings, trial, and appeal. And you'll learn how to ask questions, cross-examine adverse witnesses, select a jury, introduce exhibits and evidence, conduct discovery, do legal research, and follow the rules of court. Now, there are 28 elements to learn in courtroom strategy and procedure, not 280 or 2,000, just 28 things that you have to know. And rule one is that all of the evidence that's ever going to be used against you by your opponent is going to be furnished by you. So rule one is keep your mouth shut, don't say anything, and shut up. After rule one is out of the way, we can get to the real business of winning your case. Now, if you'd like more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you call me at 417-273-4967 and be sure to ask for my free general law CD package. Remember, that's a 4-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School. It's entertaining, educational, it's informative. Best of all, it's free of charge. And you can call and order yours right now. That number again, 417-273-4967. And courtroom strategy and procedure is also available on compact disc for adult home education. And if you're online, you can go to my website, georgegordon.org, click on to the email and send me an email request for that free general law CD package. Remember, georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about the book Lies That My Teacher Told Me. Talking about American intervention in foreign countries. You know, some books go beyond omitting the actor and they leave out the act itself. Now, half of the 12 textbooks do not even mention Wilson's takeover of Haiti. And after the U.S. Marines invaded the country in 1915, they forced the Haitian legislature to select our preferred candidate as president, just like we're doing in Iraq. When Haiti refused to declare war on Germany after the United States declared war, we dissolved the Haitian legislature. Then the United States supervised a pseudo-referendum to approve a new Haitian constitution, a little less democratic than the constitution that it replaced. The referendum passed by a hilarious 98,225-768. As Piero Gliheisus has noted, it is not that Wilson failed in his earnest efforts to bring democracy to these little countries. He never tried. He intervened to impose hegemony, not democracy. The United States also attacked Haiti's proud tradition of individual ownership of small tracts of land, which dated back to the Haitian Revolution, in favor of the establishment of large plantations. American troops forced the peasants in shackles to work on road construction crews. In 1919, Haitian citizens rose up and resisted U.S. occupation, the occupation troops, and they did so in a guerrilla war that cost more than 3,000 lives. Of course, most of those 3,000 dead were Haitians. Students who read Triumph of the American Nation learned this about Wilson's intervention in Haiti. Neither the treaty nor the continued presence of American troops restored order completely, and during the next 4 or 5 years, nearly 2,000 Haitians were killed in riots and other outbreaks of violence. This passive construction veils the circumstances about which George Barnett, a U.S. Marine general, complained to his commander in Haiti. Practically indiscriminate killing of natives has gone on for some time, and Barnett termed this violent episode the most startling thing of its kind that has ever taken place in the Marine Corps. During the first 2 decades of this century, the United States effectively made colonies of Nicaragua, Cuba, the Dominican Republic, Haiti, and several other countries in the Western Hemisphere. Wilson's reaction to the Russian Revolution solidified the alignment of the United States with Europe's colonial powers. This was the first administration to be obsessed with the specter of communism, communism abroad and at home. Wilson was blunt about it. In Billings, Montana, stumping the West to seek support for the League of Nations, he warned, quote, "There are apostles of Lenin in our own midst. I cannot imagine what it means to be an apostle of Lenin. It means to be an apostle of the night, of chaos, of disorder," unquote. Even after the White Russian alternative collapsed, Wilson refused to extend diplomatic recognition to the Soviet Union. He participated in barring Russia from the peace negotiations after World War I. He helped oust Bela Kun, the communist leader who had risen to power in Hungary. Wilson's sentiment for self-determination and democracy never had a chance against his three bedrockisms, that is, colonialism, racism, and anti-communism. A young Ho Chi Minh appealed to Woodrow Wilson at Versailles for a self-determination for Vietnam, but Ho had all three strikes against him, and Wilson refused to listen, and France retained control of Indochina. It seems that Wilson regarded self-determination as all right for, say, Belgium, but not for the likes of Latin America or Southeast Asia. Now at home, Wilson's recital policies disgraced the office that he held. His Republican predecessors had routinely appointed blacks to important offices, including those of port collector for New Orleans and the District of Columbia, and register of the Treasury. Presidents sometimes appointed African Americans as postmasters, particularly in southern towns with large black populations. African Americans took part in the Republican Party's national conventions, and they enjoyed some access to the White House. Woodrow Wilson, for whom many African Americans voted in 1912, changed all of that. Wilson, a Southerner, had been president of Princeton, the only major northern university that refused to admit blacks. Wilson was an outspoken white supremacist. Wilson's wife was even worse, and told darky stories in cabinet meetings. His administration submitted a legislative program intended to curtail the civil rights of African Americans, but Congress would not pass it. Unfazed, Wilson used his power as chief executive to segregate the federal government. He appointed Southern whites to offices traditionally reserved for blacks. Wilson personally vetoed a clause on racial equality in the Covenant of the League of Nations. The one occasion on which Wilson met with African American leaders in the White House ended in a fiasco as the president virtually threw the visitors out of his office. Woodrow Wilson's legacy was extensive. He effectively closed the Democratic Party to African Americans for another two decades, and parts of the federal government remained segregated clear into the 1950s and beyond. In 1916, the Colored Advisory Committee of the Republican National Committee issued a statement on Wilson that, though partisan, was very accurate. It said, quote, "No sooner had the Democratic administration come into power than Mr. Wilson and his advisors entered upon a policy to eliminate all colored citizens from representation in the federal government," unquote. Now, of the 12 history textbooks that I reviewed, only four accurately describe Wilson's racial policies. Land of Promise does the best job. It says, quote, "Woodrow Wilson and his administration was openly hostile to black people. Wilson was an outspoken white supremacist who believed that black people were inferior. During his campaign for the presidency, Wilson promised to press for civil rights. But once in office, he forgot his promises. And instead, Wilson ordered that white and black workers in federal government jobs be segregated from one another. This was the first time such segregation had existed in the federal government since Reconstruction back in the 1860s. When black federal employees in southern cities protested the order, Wilson had the protesters fired. In November of 1914, a black delegation asked the president to reverse his policies. Wilson was rude and hostile and refused their demands. I got to make a little comment here. Based upon these kinds of facts that I don't think the average black person in America has ever heard, and if you're black and you're listening to me right now, you probably don't believe it. Makes me wonder why the blacks have embraced the Democratic Party, which has always been, at least until Bill Clinton came along, and maybe Jimmy Carter, and the Democratic Party, have always been anti-black. The Democratic Party has always been Southern, white, and anti-black. But what we see in America, in our politics, is that the blacks vote for Democrats 9-1. You know, it's just one of those crazy anomalies that you see, and I suspect that it's based upon miseducation. I never could see any place in history, personally, where the Republican Party had discriminated against the blacks. In fact, from Reconstruction in the 1860s through at least William Howard Taft in 1912, the blacks were better off. And in fact, the blacks in America by 1900 were better off than they have been since slavery. The blacks today in 2004 are not as well off as a class, as a whole people, as they were in 1900. There, it's true, there's a lot of black, wealthy black people in America, but nowhere near the numbers that we had in 1900. And remember that there was only one Democratic administration from Reconstruction, that is 1866. That was Grover Cleveland. He was 8 years until 1912. Think of that. All the administrations were Republicans. The greatest benefits that the blacks attained from the time of slavery in 1860 through 1912 was accomplished through the Republicans. Then Wilson came along, reversed it out in 8 years, and then the Republicans tried to replace it, and then President Roosevelt came along and he maintained that principle. And of course Truman came along and he expanded it. But the blacks, for some reason, picked up on the idea that it's the Democrats that are their benefactors. The Democrats are their friends. It's never been that way historically in the United States. Now, unfortunately, except for one other textbook, The United States, A History of the Republic, Prama Stands Alone, most of the textbooks that treat Wilson's racism gave it only a sentence or two. Five of the books never even mention his black mark, or this black mark, on Wilson's presidency. One book that does, The American Way, does something even more astonishing. It invents a happy ending. Those in favor of segregation finally lost support in the Wilson administration. Their policies gradually were ended. You know, that's a lie. As old Mark Twain used to say, there's lies, damn lies, and statistics. You know, that's just a damn lie. Wilson himself was a racist, just like Helen Keller was a communist. Now, I think that communists have a right to espouse their views. I mean, after all, that's what the democratic process is all about, isn't it? And I think Woodrow Wilson had every right in the world to be a racist. What I object to is the lies that go on in our history textbooks to protect the liars and the racists from the truth. That's all. Helen Keller was a communist, and she certainly had a right to be a communist. And I think that the history textbooks ought to tell us Helen Keller, the blind, deaf, and dumb girl who overcame all of these handicaps, finally grew up to be a big girl, and she joined the Communist Party and lived happily ever after, espousing communist rhetoric and communist philosophy, which is distinctly un-American, anti-American, and unconstitutional. Our founding fathers were not socialists, they were not communists, and did not espouse
from each according to his ability and to each according to his need. They espouse the scriptures. They espouse God, Bible, home, family, and the Ten Commandments. Not communism, which is the exact antithesis to all of the above. Woodrow Wilson comes along over here, and he was a rabid racist. I think all people have a right to choose whether or not they want to live next door to blacks or Chinese or somebody else. And they have a right to make that choice. And if they want to be racist, I think they have a right to make that choice. But shouldn't we report that? Shouldn't we put that into our history book so that people can clearly see, oh, gee, this guy, this hero of the League of Nations, this hero of World War I, this great American president, Woodrow Wilson, was in fact a Southerner, and he was a racist. Well, a racist in the terms that we call racism today. Not that segregation is entirely bad. After all, God segregated the races. Do you remember that in Genesis 10 and the Tower of Babel story, or the Genesis 11? He segregated people, and he put them in different portions of the world, and gave us a statute that says you shall not oppress a stranger that's within your gate. The segregation wasn't the problem in the Wilson administration. It was firing the blacks from their jobs, and then when they complained about it, remember, they complained about it, he fired them. So let's call a spade, shall we? Now, unfortunately, except for one other textbook, that's the United States, A History of the Republic, most of the textbooks that treat Wilson's racism gave it only a sentence or two. That's a damn lie. That's covering it up. We're only going to put a sentence or two in there. And that's because we want to sell these textbooks down in the South. We don't want to tell the truth about Woodrow Wilson. After all, he was a Democrat. And back in World War I, all of the Southerners were voting the straight Democratic ticket because they were anti-black. Now, of course, the pendulum shifted back in the Nixon years. See, Nixon went down, and he turned things around. Now, the Southerners have now joined the Republican Party. The Southerners have joined the Republicans. And we call them rednecks today. Well, shouldn't we report that? Shouldn't we say, well, gee, you know, there's been a shift in the political balance. The Republicans, who were the traditional champions of the blacks and the traditional enemies of the white Southern racists, have now shifted. And now it's the Democratic Party that's the champion of the blacks, and it's the Republican Party that is now the champions of the racists of the South. I mean, wouldn't that make more sense? Well, it would be the truth, wouldn't it? And remember, their policies gradually were ended. That is, the racist policies of the Wilson administration were gradually ended. No, they weren't. They were ended by the Republicans that took over in 1921. Okay, we're about out of time. I'm going to have to break off right here. We'll take this up again. We're talking about the lies that my teacher told me. Remember, you can get a copy of this. It's James Loewen, L-O-E-W-E-N, is the author. New York Press, copyrighted 1955. Boy went on the web the other night, and he said there's more than 20 websites that carry this book or advertise this book, so I think it's worth your time, effort, and energy. All right, you've been listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School here in Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week, both in the United States and worldwide on the Internet. For more information about the Gordon Law School and the Law Hour, please go to my website. That's georgegordon.org. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to the homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has our radio log, schedule, and archives, and it can be accessed through the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. Hey, there's the signal. It says my time's up. I got to go. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station. So until then, good night, friends.